It is Saturday, March 29th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in machine-to-machine and the Internet of Things platform. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or of any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. As I said, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe. He's a web development instructor, a musician, and world traveler. Howdy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. And also we have Lindsay Lonnie, a systems analyst and web programmer. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Lindsay, I'd like to start off with you, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, sure.
But first, we got to talk about Star Trek. So, second, we're talking about Facebook and all that news. But first, Star Trek, because there's news about Star Trek. Go ahead,
yeah,
Ben.
Yeah, there is some news about Star Trek, which makes me happy. I've been watching a lot of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I want to talk about Klingons. So, Klingons are a race in Star Trek, very much about war, a lot about honor, about a lot about glory.
Worf is a Klingon.
Worf is a Klingon, if you know Star Trek at all. You may have heard of the language, the Klingon language. Mark Ockrand, one of the guys who worked on Star Trek, actually created a whole language around this race. So, a couple things. First of all, Netflix has taken Star Trek III, which is a fantastic film, offline for a bit. They've actually removed access to it. And one of the reason is that they want to fix the poor Klingon and Vulcan subtitles.
That's
now,
awesome.
I think that's amazing. Because there is a Klingon language. So, you know, what probably has happened in the past is when people do the translations, they just kind of make something up based on context. But they're actually... is a proper translation for the things that they're saying in the movie.
Okay, first off, I work for Netflix. I didn't hear about the story until a few minutes ago, so I haven't actually looked at it. I don't know anything about it. But what you're saying, was this a public release from Netflix that said that this happened?
Was this speculation? I can't tell.
Oh, okay.
Because a lot of different news outlets report on it slightly differently. I imagine that it's probably kind of a, like Netflix told them, but didn't do a public release kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the email thread to send you to find out what the case is, but I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment, except to say that... when we did a hackathon thing, I actually worked a bit on the subtitle system in Netflix and how to pull subtitles out. And we do offer, you know, subtitles on content. And it would make sense in Klingon to have the right subtitles. But I'm really surprised that the film footage you get when the Klingons or any other alien race speaks doesn't have the actual text in English translated on screen. Because, you know, it seems like it'd be part of the film. It wouldn't seem like it would be some subset feed.
Yeah,
like if you're in a movie theater, it's got to be there, right?
It's not like some Klingons are going to walk into a movie theater and be like, no, we don't need the subtitles.
Like, there's probably less than 1,000 people that actually speak Klingon that don't need it, right? And of course, all those people know the movie verbatim anyway, so you wouldn't need a translation.
I'm trying to imagine the scenario of who gets to be the expert that says, no, those aren't good enough.
I think there's books on it. I mean,
there is at least one book.
Is there
and I think, I might be totally wrong, but I think it was released in 1984. So it's an old book, and I might be totally wrong on that, actually. Don't quote me on
30
that.
30 years old. So
and also Vulcan. There's the Vulcan language as well.
The thing that does make sense to me, though, is because, you know, I don't want to sound like a commercial for Netflix. I do, though, so I'm saying it anyway. How do I do this? I don't know. Anyway, there are a lot of awesome video streaming options there. Is that better?
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, though, it would make sense that we need it in different languages, right? So if we offer subtitles in French and the film itself was an English main track and therefore the footage is English, the subtitles that would be part of the film that would be the Klingon translation would be in English. But if you're listening in French subtitles, you'd need that.
Yeah, so
that would
make a lot of sense. You want to be able to go Klingon to French. Klingon
right.
to German.
You wouldn't want to go from Klingon to English to French, because that would be not as realistic, you know?
No. Have you ever tried doing that with Babelfish? Translating something from English to, like, Japanese to German to, and then back to English? It's really wacky. And then the other piece of news that I have, Star Trek news, that also relates to Klingons is, for the first time, CBS has given their okay to create a Klingon beverage, a Star Trek-themed beverage that a brewery is actually distributing. And it's a Klingon beer. It's called Klingon Warnog. Now, I was a little bit disappointed by this. Like, okay, cool, we've got a Klingon beverage, but, I mean, we should have Klingon blood wine. That's
obviously
the beverage.
Duh.
Like, okay, so you watch Star Trek.
The problem is to make Klingon blood wine is probably a special species that you have to drain or something. So, and that species doesn't actually exist. So it's a little
harder
to make it.
If you look more into it, if you were to do it correctly, you would have to have congealed blood in there. So that's bad news. But like, honestly, you watch Star Trek and they're constantly talking about blood wine. You know, let's go barrels of blood wine. How much the 2309 is a good vintage of blood wine. And so I looked on Memory Alpha, which is a Star Trek wiki, believe it or not, this thing exists, and it's very, very complete. Apparently, Klingon Warnog was mentioned like 2 times, and just in passing. But they wanted to make a beer. They didn't want to make a blood wine.
Right. You can't make a beer and call it blood wine. That doesn't work at all.
No, not at all.
Okay, so you talked
Romulan,
about... But
Romulan
you
ale.
That
could have worked.
That's true.
Hmm. Yeah.
But who wants to drink Romulan ale?
Or Saurian brandy.
Romulans.
There's so many Star Trek beverages.
We have nerded out so high on this one. Let's do one more. Star Trek 6. In the Star Trek 6, there's a dinner. And the Klingon Chancellor, Gorkon, makes a toast. And he says, and he names the film.
Undiscovered country.
Thank you very much.
The future.
Yes. And that's amazing. I'm reading the Wikipedia article, and you quoted it perfectly.
And then everyone,
nerd.
And then Spock.
So Spock recognizes the quote and says, Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1. To which Gorkon replies with a statement about the original Klingon text of Shakespeare.
You have not experienced Shakespeare until you've read it in the original Klingon.
Ta, ba, ta. To be or not to be.
Something like that. Uproarious laughter.
So there's a whole movement to take all the works of Shakespeare and to find the original Klingon translations by fixing them.
Yeah.
And that's a whole movement. And it's if you want to learn more about it, you can go to the Klingon Hamlet on Wikipedia to learn all about
that's
that.
That's kind of amazing. Also, I just want to do a shout out. Awesome. Yeah. I actually was going to
I just showed the picture of the cover of the Klingon Hamlet, and it's like a Klingon with a Klingon skull and a bat in his hand.
About
awesome.
Maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I was in the SDSU bookstore and I was about to buy that.
Oh,
and then
wonderful.
I decided, you know what? Am I really going to read this whole thing?
You're like, great.
I don't know Klingon, you know?
Author William Shakespeare.
It's amazing. I do also have to just do a quick shout out. I've been watching a lot of Deep Space Nine with my partner, and it's fantastic. And I've also been listening to a podcast where they go through every single episode and they cover it. And it's called The Gamma Quadrant. They've since stopped doing it because they got to the last episode. But if you've seen all of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and you want to, you know, listen
to
some people talk about it, it's actually a really fun podcast. But be really careful. If you haven't seen all the episodes, there are tons of spoilers. They're always talking about what's going to happen in the next season and all that stuff. So, but yeah, that's the Gamma Quadrant. I'll put a link up on the
podcast. And of course, Deep Space Nine is available on Netflix.
And it's
sorry. So messed up. It is though, right? I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's messed up.
All right, let's talk about Facebook.
All right, Facebook. So the big news was that Facebook is acquiring a virtual reality technology company called Oculus VR for $2 billion. The deal is expected to close in the second quarter of 2014. And what they make is the Oculus Rift, which is a virtual reality headset that was originally funded on Kickstarter.
Lindsay, when I had an Oculus Rift for 2 weeks, did you get to play with it?
I did not.
I am so sorry. I should have come to your house.
Neither did I.
You didn't either, Ben?
What's up?
Let me just tell you, it was awesome.
Was it?
Yes. This thing, okay, Oculus Rift, I had it for a while and I put it on lots of people. Every time I saw somebody, I was like, put it on them, got my laptop out. It was kind of a mess. But so it produces a 3D image, has an LCD screen that goes in front of your face, and there's two lenses that give the focus of your eye onto that each screen, and then you get two images on the LCD. Yeah, Ben.
Wait, this is like a huge headset that
no,
you put on,
it's
right?
Actually quite light.
Is it?
Yeah. It's It's really large,
but
it's light.
It's
not. It covers
your eyes.
It covers your eyes completely. In fact, it's a blindfold.
Yeah. It's not like Google Glass. This really lightweight, teeny thing.
This is an all-inclusive virtual reality.
Yeah.
Google Glass sometimes is referred to as augmented reality in the sense that you use it at the same time as normal reality. And in Oculus, you totally cover all your eye senses. In fact, what was great about the experience of passing around the Oculus Rift with people is that I'd put it on their face, they'd get the momentum, they'd get the idea, they'd start experiencing it, which I'll describe in a second if you want, and then I'd take it off, and what was fun about it is you put it on them, they were then blindfolded, right? They saw an image, but it wasn't the reality. So you're basically putting this device on them to blindfold them in all outside senses. I'm taking photographs and videotaping their experiences and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've got this great footage of people that I know experiencing it while they're blindfolded. They don't know they're being filmed. I haven't shown anybody because I'm not evil. But what's great about it is that they have this great personal experience. Then you take it off them. They talk about, inside there I was blah, blah, blah. They talked about being in some place. So you remove their sense of sight, and then they talk about being in a virtual space. So it was kind of incredible.
Like being transported.
Yeah. They actually use that kind of technology for getting people over fear of heights, for example. Huh. Like they'll put them in this virtual space where when you look down, you see this really thin thing, and you have to walk across this thin thing, and there's a big gap.
So in the demo of Oculus Rift that I gave to everybody, they'd put it on, and it's inside the room. The space you get is kind of an island in this kind of tropical environment, and there's a building, and you can walk around by using the keyboard. And as you turn your head, it completely locks like you're in the environment, and there doesn't seem to be any delay. So you don't get nauseous, unless, of course, you use the keyboard to spin the character, and then it's disorienting and people get nauseous.
Yeah.
And then you go upstairs. The top of the stairs is a little outlook, and you can go to this like banister and have a one-story fall. And basically, whenever people did that, they would have that experience of reaching forward to grab the banister to stop them from falling. And it was this weird thing because they're completely blindfolded and they're spinning in a chair, and all of a sudden they put their hands up like they're going to fall. It's great. Anyway, Oculus Rift was a lot of fun. And the newer version has much higher resolution. You could see the pixels easily. And I got to say that it's the first time I've played with VR over the years, and there's a lot of interest in it in the tech world. The Oculus Rift, they did it right in a lot of sense, and I was kind of impressed with it. Now, why the heck is Facebook buying it, Lindsay? What is it? Why?
That's the big question. A lot of people are like, what is going on with Zuckerberg and Facebook? Why do they want this VR headset? Mark Zuckerberg said that virtual reality has the potential to be the next great computing evolution after the transition to mobile devices. Not everyone agrees with that, but he seems to feel strongly enough about it to pay $2 million for this company. And he said you could use it for things like sitting courtside at a sporting event, studying with a group of students, consulting face-to-face with a doctor, things like that. So when you look at it like that, you think, well, maybe there will be use for this. But like you said, you're kind of blindfolded and immersed. So I don't see how it could be used for something live time. People are using FaceTime and stuff like that to spend time with their families, but I don't know if it can be used for things like that and render a 3D environment on the fly.
Right.
That would be a cool thing.
Yeah, it would depend on the computer, of course, behind it. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I can see uses for that, but
I can imagine it would be relatively simple to do that, but you wouldn't get a lot of rich quality out of it. We don't have stereoscopic cameras most of the time, webcams, right? We have one webcam. Right. Yeah. The way to do this right would have two webcams on your computer on the corners, and then do it that way. Or with facial recognition and 3D mapping, you could potentially produce a 3D head out of a 2D image and have the people actually look at you, which kind of be cool.
Mm-hmm.
What it reminds me, of course, is Ernest Cline's amazing book, Ready Player One.
That was a good book.
Yeah,
I read it too.
That was a good book. Mm-hmm. Ernie came on the show on Geek Speak in 2011 to talk about his book right before it came out. I actually got a preview copy and read it, and I've kind of tried to hand it to everybody I know. Have you read Ready Player One yet?
I have not read it yet.
The reason why Ready Player One is a great book is it's a futuristic book where there's an augmented reality happening all the time, but the person that made that world grew up in the 80s, and then there's this big contest to find a treasure map, basically, inside the game, and all the clues are about 80s pop. So the entire book is just jam full of 80s pop, and you and me being the same age, we 80s, find that stuff compelling.
80s pop culture.
Culture,
not 80s pop.
Right, not 80s pop, sorry. 80s culture. So there's all the music that I listened to as a kid, and basically if you were born in the 70s and 80s, this book is just like, and you're a tech head, this book is just made for you. Ready Player One. Now, in Ready Player One, the virtual world is called Oasis, and it is kind of a take a Facebook social scene and make it every type of experience and 3D and a world map, right? So having the kind of power and craziness behind like something like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's ability to do what he wants with tons of money, mm-hmm. kind of brings that idea into, you know, larger scope in the sense that in the book, Oasis is a universal thing. Everyone does it, just like Facebook's a universal thing and everybody does mm-hmm. it, right?
I mean, it's kind of weird to be in this space where everybody's going to one company's website for their social needs.
Yeah.
Like, that's novel. That's unusual.
All we can hope is Mark Zuckerberg is as great a protagonist in the story as in Ready Player One. The hero in that is awesome.
Yeah.
Of course, the book starts with the hero dying, so...
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, the one like Great wah. Oasis, but no, it's a great book. No, yeah. That's the first like sentence.
Yeah. That's the first.
It might be the second or third sentence. It's the first page, but
yeah,
definitely read Ready Player One by Ernie Cline, and then think again about this whole Facebook merger.
Yeah, and listen to our show on it too.
Yeah.
It was a really good interview.
August 13th, 2011. I'll link to it from today's show, which of course is March 29th, 2014. All right. More on that story? Are we good?
Yeah, there's a lot of just little details I have, so if you need to move to something else. But there's a lot of rift in the community about this. A lot of people talking about it. I was a little surprised at the hype that went on with this, actually.
A lot of anger.
Yeah, people very angry about it. So people's perception of Kickstarter is one thing. So a lot of people perceive it as a grassroots kind of thing, when really it's just a way to get funding for your startup.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that funded Oculus on Kickstarter are upset because they're saying, well, I didn't put my money in there in order to have that go to Facebook.
Right, know? Right. Mm-hmm. Make it an asset of a company that doesn't respect privacy. Right. I mean, that's kind of the sentiment of the geeks that have been upset about it.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So there's that side of the fence. And even the guy who created Minecraft was in talks with Oculus in order to create a version of Minecraft for mm-hmm. the VR. And after the Facebook thing, he said, no, I'm not going to do that now.
I think that'll probably change. But also,
right.
There have been ports of a Minecraft environment on Oculus Rift, which requires rendering from two points of view. That's how you actually get 3D vision. Stereoscopic vision.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been hacks, of course. So it was kind of exciting to see what would happen. I don't know. I feel like the people that spent the time and energy to do this project, then made a Kickstarter campaign, then pulled in Carmack, who's this amazing 3D visionary kind of programmer, to pull in part of the project. Those people that spent their life and blood and effort for years working on this project, if they feel the best way to move that project forward is to sell it to or merge with a large company, I think it makes a lot of sense. I personally don't like the idea that just because we haven't liked a lot of the stuff that Facebook's done, it's a bad idea for this. It could shift, this group could shift Facebook's mission a little bit differently. And the other thing is that what Facebook currently is not what it will be in 10 years, right?
Yeah, and on that note, the other side of the fence is that Oculus has a new chief scientist, Michael Abrash, who, you know, originally was involved with Quake and kind of early seen for programming games and stuff like that. And he thinks it's a great thing because VR has kind of stagnated of how much it can grow.
Yeah.
And now they have all this money and funding at their disposal to move it to the next level. So he's excited
about that. A big thing about the Oculus is that to play and develop in that space, to actually make a game, you have to assume that there'll be like no one using it, right? Comparatively. You know, now that I'm kind of working in a company that does kind of mass scale where there's millions of people, when you think of, oh, there's a group of people that want to do this and they'll buy it and there's, you know, 6,000 of them. Well, that's not actually enough to build a full game, right?
Right.
You need a lot of people to make investment in software really pay off because it's so expensive to develop complex software. So seeing this allows us to potentially see a lot more developers on board in VR, and therefore the VR world would expand. And that's why it's exciting to me, yeah.
Right, and, you know, the developers, so far, a lot of people are saying, well, they don't even have a public product yet that they're releasing, you know, to the consumers. They just have this dev kit, and you can buy a version and get the dev kit, or they're giving it to people. And there's about 75,000 of those out there already, but not a big market. But now they're saying that they could sell it for less, potentially, you know, make it more consumer-ready. So who knows whether it'll be good or bad, but I can see both sides.
I can also see a situation where instead of using your little tiny screen of your device, you plug in a headset that you flip down and you've got glasses that are fully immersive and you're sitting on a bus blind to the outside world with a mobile device in a completely virtual world. And as a geek, that excites me. Snow crash, here we come. All right, we're going to talk about space news in a minute. Ben's got a cool story. And then, you know, it's tax season coming up. We're going to tell you a little bit about taxes and maybe Bitcoin. But stay with us here on Geek Speak. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Ben Jaffe. We're talking about tech news here on Geek Speak today. Ben, what's up with space?
So, if you think about what's in our solar system, what things have rings in your mind?
Planets. Like suns.
Saturn. Which planets?
Oh, Saturn has it.
Saturn.
Doesn't Neptune have one?
Neptune.
Or, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then
there's a moon,
Uranus
right?
might.
Yeah, Uranus
I
does.
I think that's it on rings.
Jupiter actually has.
Oh, really?
Teeny little rings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Cool. And we don't really think of them as rings because they're so teeny, you know.
Comparatively.
comparatively. I mean, I guess you could call the sun having rings, like the asteroid belt or something. We don't really think of those as rings, though. As it turns out,
in a ring around the sun, so that's all.
Okay, all right, that's fine. Well, in that case, then we're like a planet moon of the sun planet.
Go on.
I don't know. See, this is like when you start thinking this way, you realize, okay, our naming conventions for everything is completely arbitrary, right?
Right.
Like, okay, why is a planet? Okay.
So is something new around that has rings?
Yes, actually. We discovered an asteroid. A teeny little asteroid with rings.
Cool.
How wacky is that? So it's not actually too teeny. It's not really, really small. It's 250 kilometers across. So that's
cosmically pretty small.
Yeah, that's a fair size. That's 150 miles for those USians of us. good said, Ben. So it's called Chariklo, and it's the smallest body that we've ever found that has rings. And it was discovered and announced by a team in Brazil,
cool.
Rio de Janeiro, the National Observatory there. And it's just, it's kind of wacky.
Is it in the plane of our solar system or is it askew? Not the asteroid, but it's
Actually, it's got an irregular orbit, so it's...
Oh, it has a regular orbit as well.
Yeah, it's not like... Yeah. It's not, yeah. So one of the other things is that raised the question, why... Are there, like, how did the rings get there?
Yeah.
And why are they still there?
Right, because normally you have kind of a chaotic movement like that. You'll get collisions and they'll form a new body, right? They'll gravitationally pull to each other and you'll get a larger clump.
That often can happen.
It'll degrade and just mash into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, like, you have a huge, huge planet and then you get a collision with the planet. A bunch of debris gets thrown up into space and orbits, and that's how you get the rings. But with an asteroid that's like 250 kilometers wide, that's teeny, you know? So a collision with that asteroid, you imagine, would just kind of destroy it. So they're kind of doing some speculation about how we got that. There also is speculation that there may be a small satellite, like a moon kind of thing, a small satellite around there, which is kind of keeping the rings together, actually. So that's another theory that we have. And the way we actually discovered this is the same way that we look for exoplanets with the Kepler Space Telescope.
Cool.
We just look at some far away point in light. We look at some far star, and then we watch as the asteroid moves in front of the star. And so normally you would see the light from the star, and then the asteroid eclipses it, and the light goes all the way down to zero.
And then it comes back up.
Yeah, and it comes back up. Well, it turns out with this asteroid, we saw a teeny little dip, and then it came back up, and then the big dip, and then it came back up, and then another teeny little dip.
Cool.
A little bilaterally symmetrical dip, and that's what the rings were.
And so do we have any theories on how it was created, like Gully Foyle did it or something? Or?
I think there's some theories. I think it's definitely too soon to say. This literally was released, I think, yesterday. No, I'm sorry, 3 days ago or something like that. But
all right.
They have a really cool, also just as a geek bit, part of it.
Yeah.
If you go to the website, you can look at this neat little animation that they made that really shows
what it
very
looks like.
Clearly also how it eclipses and all that stuff.
All right. It's coming up on April, which means tax time in the U.S. Lindsay, uh-oh, what's going on with taxes lately?
All right. Well, have you heard of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I have heard of Bitcoin. Amazing.
We did an episode on it a couple months ago.
Sure.
So it's a peer-to-peer payment system and digital it's kind of a digital currency anyway. Oh, it's open source software. As soon as Bitcoin started to appreciate in value, the IRS took notice and decided that they might want a piece of that.
Yeah.
In order to collect taxes from Bitcoin gains this season, it needed to quickly decide whether to tax it as a currency, a commodity, or an asset.
Okay. So I understand what a currency is. Commodity would be like it had a physical worth, like corn or something, and that would be a certain type of tax. And then assets like taxes. I mean, like, I'm sorry, like a like stock in a company or something, right?
Exactly. Where yeah, currency is like a pocket full of dollars. Commodities yeah. like a bar of gold or, you know, like you said,
okay.
corn, whatever. And then an asset is like stock.
Okay.
A company stock or something like that. So this week, they decided that Bitcoin will be treated as an asset for tax purposes, which is like treating it like stock.
Hmm.
So any money that you make from mining or selling Bitcoin will be treated as though you earned or sold shares.
Okay.
Right. So
that seems like the easiest way to fit in there, right? If you try to make it a commodity, it's not really a commodity. It's a number. That would be strange. And if they said it was a currency, that would be a lot of meaning to it. There would be a lot of inferred other meaning behind that. So
yeah, they would have to have benefits like regulatory protections like FDIC insurance and stuff like that.
Which doesn't exist.
A currency.
So that means it's a speculative system.
Right.
Like the IRS just
said. That's how most people have been using it. I mean, you know, you can go out and buy sushi with Bitcoin and everything. You could buy a Tesla or whatever with Bitcoin. But most people have been buying and selling Bitcoin as a speculative thing. It's kind of a futures market thing.
Right. So that makes sense that it would be. So the IRS just released this last week.
Yeah.
So if you already filed your taxes, get back on it if you've got any. I guess, Ben, you've got some Bitcoin, right?
Yes.
IRS, go looking for Ben.
Right.
Been outed. Yeah, but the other side of that is that if they go down in value, you can subtract the loss from your capital gain and income.
So this is probably a good thing for you, Ben, right?
So my
because they're down right now.
This announcement happened, it went down.
I just have to say.
Really? Yeah. This affected the Bitcoin value. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Everything affects the Bitcoin value. That's such a, it goes up and down.
Look.
Like, you just like.
Look at my cute doggy video.
There's
Bitcoin
a slight,
value.
There's
down.
A slight breeze and.
Totally.
I do have to say, the teeny amount of Bitcoins that I do own, I really wish I had put that amount of money into Bitcoin when it was worth 2 cents.
Or less than it was when you did.
Like, that would be amazing.
Are you at a negative value right now? What's Bitcoin? Is at $500 a coin now?
Yeah,
right?
so Bitcoin.
At one point, it went up to 1,200 or so.
Yeah, just briefly, it went up, down. But generally, an uptrend until it hit about 12 something. And then,
yeah. And so, are you in the rear? Have you made money? Have you lost money? Is it kind of even? What's the status on that whole speculation thing? I'm kind of curious. And just tell me and 40,000 people.
Right. About your finances, Ben.
Okay, we'll move on. Sorry, Ben. You don't look comfortable.
No, I will say two things. One is I've lost money, but it's been worth it because it's been really fun learning about how this works. Like, it's not just, oh, okay, so you print some cash and then people pass it to each other using their hands. Like, that's a very simple system. Bitcoin is way more complicated and complex and brilliant.
So you've lost money, but you learned about technology at the time.
So the
and
journey.
I've done a very similar thing to that, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah. Okay. And the other thing is, I don't come after me. I've got like a teeny, teeny bit of Bitcoins.
Right. It's play money.
I really wish I had put $100 into Bitcoins when they were under a dollar.
Right,
that would have been great.
Lindsay, anything else on that story?
No, that's pretty
all right.
Much it.
So my little hint of how I've wasted money to invest in technology. Probably 6 months ago, I was really fed up with AT&T, my cell phone carrier, spending way too much money. And there's a company called Ting, which is really popular on the podcasting environment. And Ting is a sub-carrier, a cell phone service that actually rides on top of, I believe, the Sprint network.
Yeah.
Right? So I looked around and was like, there's got to be an AT&T one. If Sprint's got that, it's got to be an AT&T one. So I looked around and I found a company called Net10. And so I went ahead and invested in moving my phone number over to Net10. And during this process, a couple times I mentioned on the air that I was doing this, and I'd tell people how it went. And I got an email recently that said, "Hey, Lyle, you never said how it went."
How'd it go?
So here's the story of my use of going from AT&T to Ting. So
tell your story. I'll tell my story.
Good. And you did Ting, and I did
Net10. Ting. You did Net10.
And Lindsay, we'll find out what you're going to do in a second. So Net10, I went ahead and bought a startup kit, which I assumed would be everything I needed physically to move over. And what you need physically is a SIM card, the little chip in the phone that actually identifies the phone to the carrier. That SIM card is locked and actually kind of produced, if you will, by the carrier, and therefore I need to get one of theirs. So I went and spent, I don't know, $10 or something like that. To get this on Amazon, and they shipped me this thing, and when I was ready finally to do it, I stuck it in my phone and I started the process and found out that actually there is no way to start the service without also getting a prepaid card, which you have to get at like a store. So I got a starter kit, but that wasn't enough to start. That was really frustrating. So I go onto their website. Their website is split around a lot. It's hard to navigate. It's, you know, I'm a web developer, so I have a lot of judgment about these kind of things.
Yeah, right.
And it was confusing. The documentation wasn't clear. The service plans weren't clear. They really wanted to get your phone number and start the initiation process prior to doing telling you anything. And if you start your phone number and do that process, at some point they ask for this prepaid card. You cannot use a credit card. You cannot sign up. You have to go to a store, which I finally ended up doing, and buying a prepaid month of service. And they've got like $30 up to $60. And those plans vary in what they offer you. Mm-hmm. And I think I got a $50 plan, which was 1 month of service for them. Now, granted, that's still cheaper than a month of AT&T, and sure, theoretically, it should be exactly the same service in a lot of ways. So,
wait, you said theoretically.
Well, and the reason I say theoretically is when I was on the tech support call with AT&T, frustrated about some bill they had charged me for, you know, the thing that everybody does every once in a while, hates their carriers and such. When I was on the phone with them, I was like, why don't I just switch to the Net 10? And AT&T rep said, oh, because their service isn't as good. And I, as a technical person, go, but it's the same baseline service. Like, it's the same antennas. It's, mm-hmm. I was like, "That are you telling me the truth? Can do you have a documentation for that? Could you inform me, AT&T, why you say that your service is better than the carrier that runs on top of your service?"
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And he didn't have anything except for a quote on the website, which said the same thing with no data. So I didn't know. So I thought, well, the best way to do this is to throw some money at it and find out for myself, is it good?
Okay.
So I did similar to you in Bitcoin, right? So I went and paid for the service and transferred my system over, and it was a total nightmare to do that. I finally got it working, and I had an iPhone 4 at the time, and it worked, and everything was fine. And in fact, my phone calls back and forth were fine. It transferred in pretty quickly. My cell phone all of a sudden was going that direction. I lost the visual voicemail service, which was really cool. I lost that, so I had to call in, which I kind of missed. Around this time, I decided that I really wanted to switch to Android from iOS. So then I went and switched to a Nexus 5.
You just got to make it hard.
I got to make it hard for myself. So then I switched to that. Now, I've got Google Glass, and the reason I switched to a Nexus 5, an Android device, is Google Glass pairs better with that, so I could have geolocation mm-hmm. and text messaging on my face. So I did that whole process. Am I talking fast enough yet? Let me get a glass of water.
So, what happened next?
Thank you, Ben. Nice, Phil. So, I got Net 10 working with my Nexus 5, my cell phone working that way, and my Glass working, and there was one hitch.
Okay, what's your hitch?
The hitch was that the Google Glass app on the Android device tells the carrier that it's actually tethering, and tethering is not supported in Net 10. And so I hacked around that for...
Is that supported in AT&T?
Yes. You can buy a tethering plan. Mm-hmm. It's more expensive in AT&T. It's another, I don't know, some amount of money a month.
You got it. Have it, but you got to pay.
You got to pay. Net 10, they don't offer it at all. I couldn't pay for it. I couldn't do it. And so there's a lot of ways to actually have your cell phone lie to the carrier that says, no, this data is coming from the cell phone. It's not coming mm-hmm. from an external device, which it was.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the Google Glass app wasn't playing that game. So then I went in and started hacking the data structure in Android. I then installed CyanogenMod. Mm-hmm. Which is a different alternative operating system on my Nexus.
Gives you more control 5. Over yeah. all your stuff. Yeah.
At this point, I got hired by Netflix. And Netflix said, here, we'll pay for a phone for you. And I went, gosh, then everything will work perfectly. So I actually I developed the iOS app. I'm one of the mm-hmm. developers of the iOS app. So I need to have an iOS device anyway. So switch over to, I'm back at AT&T. I've got an iPhone 5S now. It's my phone, and I feel like a complete technical failure. Only in as much as I switched to Net 10 was for price reduction. That's the real reason,
uh-huh,
right?
Yeah.
And I couldn't get the tethering to work with Google Glass. I think that's been fixed now. The Net 10 service itself, yes, it's cheaper. It's just as good if you don't need tethering. So there is my synopsis on Net 10. Oh, and their customer service is worse than AT&T.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What?
Oh, it's horrible.
Oh, no.
I mean, their website's hard and confusing. You can't log in with a password. It's just a mess.
So they're cheaper, but it's not worth it.
For example.
For you.
For example, if you don't pay for the continuing plan, you have to buy the card once in a while. The first month, they text you like 3 times before the plan's going to go. The second month, they don't say anything to you. Your phone just stops working. Do you know your phone's not working? No. Yeah, that was frustrating.
You seem frustrated.
I was frustrated. So if you're going to do it to save a little bit of money, just figure out if it's worth it, right? You're not going to love Net 10.
But how do you figure out if it's worth it unless you do it?
Because
you listen to Geek Speak.
It's going to be painful, and it's going to be annoying, and it's going to be a process, and you'll save like $30 or $40 a month.
So that's Net 10.
Yeah.
I do have to say, I had never heard of Net 10 until you brought them up.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard of MetroPCS. I had heard of Ting. So maybe there's something to be said for how much you've heard of them, right?
Sure.
I mean, the same goes for anything. So I can tell you my story. I don't know. We got a break, though.
Yeah,
so
let's do
how
that.
How about after the break, I'll tell you my story.
This is Geek Speak. That's Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. And Lindsay here quietly is here as well. We'll be back in just a minute. And this is Geek Speak on KSP. Everything we talk about is available, more information available at geekspeak.org. Just look up today's show, which of course is March 29th, 2014. In the age of science and technology, do philosophers still matter? Yes, says writer Rebecca Goldstein. Even 2,000-year-old philosophers. Rebecca Goldstein talks to KSP's Robert Pauly about her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophers Won't Go Away. That's tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project, of course, on KSP or online at npr.org. Now, you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're talking to Ben Jaffe and Lindsay Lonnie. Ben, you used Ting as your cell phone carrier.
Yes.
And you know what? Let me just finish one thing about
sure.
Net 10. Yes, you can tether with Net 10. It works fine. You can't tether with Net 10 with Google Glass, or you couldn't when I left the service. So to be clear, yes, you can do tethering plans with Net 10. They do not support it, so you're breaking the rules when you do it, but you can do it.
It's
Ben,
complicated.
Yes.
So something that I've noticed in hearing your various rants over the several months and my own experiences is if you're with AT&T or Sprint or Verizon. Are you recording me on your Google Glass?
I'm taking
Glass?
A picture of you on Google
I
Glass.
I see.
Website.
Okay. Yeah. Very subtle. If you're with AT&T or Sprint or Verizon, all you're negotiating is a relationship between you and the carrier directly, right? If you're doing something like Ting or Net 10 or MetroPCS or one of those, piggybacking, right? Piggybacking on another big service. You're not negotiating just your relationship with your new carrier. You're also kind of indirectly negotiating their relationship, AT&T and Net 10, or Sprint and Ting. And that relationship can be kind of tenuous or weird. And so there are all these issues that you run into, like, why can't I do this? I can do it on Sprint. It's the same technology. It's the same towers. It's the same phone. Why can't I do this now? And that's the reason, right? So here's the takeaway that I have with Ting. I'm still with Ting. I love Ting. And as far as I can tell, I'm going to stay with Ting instead of going back to one of the big carriers. I've had very good experiences. However, there are some phones that you can't use with Ting. For example, if I had an iPhone, which I don't. I have an Android phone.
They recently started supporting iPhones.
Yes, but always with kind of fuzzy language.
Yes,
like
you're
they're
right.
Not going to say like, "Oh, we support the iPhone 4." They'll say the iPhone 4
has worked for some people.
Has worked for
network.
Some people,
yeah, yeah.
And we're calling it the iPhone 4 beta support, right? They
right.
add that. And the reason is because Apple basically Sprint doesn't want to risk their relationship with Apple by allowing Ting to support Apple products directly.
Fantastic.
So if Ting says, we support the iPhone, and something goes wrong, then Sprint's going to be like, oh boy, well, we let
Sorry,
them do
Apple.
That.
Yeah.
Sorry, Apple. And then Apple's going to not like them
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you
okay.
Know, you know how Apple can be. So that's kind of the situation. So depending on what phone you're on, you can or might not be able to switch to Ting. If you're on the iPhone 5, last time I checked, you weren't able to switch with the iPhone 5. You could with the iPhone 4. It wouldn't be officially supported, but they pretty much support you just fine, you know? So it's very much this, it's yeah, it's interesting.
I knew that Ting was a better company than Net 10. And the reason
yeah.
I went to Net 10 is I just don't have Sprint coverage at my house.
Okay.
And that's kind of important. So
also, Ting's customer service, fantastic.
Yes.
You call them, they pick up the phone, and it's a human.
So if you're already using Sprint and you want to switch away to a cheaper service or a pay-what-you-use service, that's the thing about Ting, is that you really pay what you use,
yeah,
then Ting might be a really good option for you.
I'm paying about 30 to 40% each month.
Less.
For what? Yeah, than I was paying on Sprint. I don't want this to be a Ting ad.
It sounds like a Ting ad.
But I just want to say that my experience personally has been very, very good. And I would recommend this to my friends. I'm not saying go and switch because, you know, also you might not have the right phone for it. So.
And as a reminder, the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP or the affiliated programs of affiliated organizations of the Geeks. They're just our opinions, and we don't know what we're talking about. Lindsay, what are you doing about phone carriers?
Yeah, thank you for that disclaimer before this, because I actually did a bunch of this research like over 6 months ago, and I haven't rechecked the sites because I wasn't aware we were going to get deep into this. Yeah, but it's a great topic because with the major carriers, everyone's paying so much money in signing these huge contracts. And I had two phones, one for work and one for personal, and I have all Android phones. I've never had an iPhone. And so I was wondering, well, I'm paying so much, and then I'm paying an extra $40 a month because it's a smartphone, and then I'm paying an extra $40 a month for a hotspot in case my internet goes down.
Right.
And then I've got, you know, because once you start adding phones, it's cheap for each phone. But if they're smartphones and you want all these other features and visual voicemail, it just really stacks up.
Yeah, it does.
And so I wanted to simplify. And when I was doing my research, I came across a company called Kitty Wireless. And, you know, they
make
jokes about their name and all of that kind of stuff. But they seem to have really good customer service. And they're a reseller. So you've got MVNOs, mobile virtual network operators that resell the major networks. Mm-hmm. But I
this
wanted
is what,
to
use, this is what Ting and Net10 are you taking advantage of.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what Kitty does, they're basically a kind of a reseller. They resell Page Plus cellular accounts, and Page Plus runs on the Verizon network. So my criteria was that I wanted to save money, I didn't want a contract, but I wanted to keep my phone. And a lot of those carriers, they want you to use one of the two or three models that they support because they know them inside and out, and there's not as much X factors with the usage. And so they had, I had an old Droid 2 that I was no longer using, and that was one of the models that they supported. So I started looking into using that.
So is this a secondary line for you, because your primary line's a work line, or how do you use that switch?
This was going to be just for my personal.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So it didn't have to be the newest featured phone or any of that. It just had to be something that you use all the time for your personal, you know, personal calls.
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily thinking I was going to, you know, tether my computer and work.
So have you turned it on yet? Have you turned on Kitty yet?
I have not.
So will you give us an update when you do, and we can continue this another month or so?
I definitely will.
Awesome.
So, you know, because I definitely wanted to use Verizon because I was more interested in the coverage than, you know, supposedly Sprint is faster in some areas and AT&T is more reliable, but I was more interested in the countrywide coverage for traveling and stuff like that. So I was reading about it on xdadevelopers.com, which is a great site for, you know, if you have weird behavior with your phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was looking at people that had my same phone that were using Kitty and other resellers and using the cards, and what kind of bugs they were running into, what kind of behavior. And so I felt like there was good information out there, and Kitty also has a good forum. And if you have a problem, like Ting, you can call them and they will broker that, you know.
When you say Kitty has a good forum, you mean that forum actually is a good website to use?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one of the things. Like, the forums were the answer on the Net 10 thing, but the forum software was so bad that it was hard to navigate, and there was so much cruft of communication that I couldn't get data out of it.
Right.
Oh, man, these little details make it really, it matters a lot when you spend a lot of time. So you like that whole environment around the Kitty. What is it called? Kitty Mobile?
Kitty Wireless.
Kitty Wireless. Okay. So we'll get an update on Kitty Wireless. I think we need to move on, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that's fantastic. I'm looking forward to it. And if you have a cell carrier experience, good or bad, and want to share it and vent it with us, what I'll do is I'll collate all that stuff that you email us, and I'll put it up on today's website so that we kind of keep a flow of information about what's happening linked to today's show. So just email us. We're available via email. We're geeks@geekspeak.org, or of course you can just go up to geekspeak.org and click on contact us if you'd like. And of course we're on Facebook and Google and Twitter and all that, and you can participate there, and we'll also respond and read and all those things. Look forward to seeing you online. Ben, since we're talking about cell phones, we should mention that you shouldn't drive with cell phones, right?
Yes, indeed. The National Safety Council recently released the 2014 edition of Injury Facts Reserved, which I thought was kind of a funny name. But the contents of this report are not particularly funny. They're talking about, well, a number of things. One of the things that they're talking about is motor vehicle crashes. Cell phone use is now estimated to be involved in 26% of all motor vehicle crashes.
Wow.
So that's up from last year, and that's a lot. That's one in four. So additionally, 5% of those crashes of the 26% are cell phone use. 5% of all crashes involve texting estimated. Okay. 21% involve drivers talking on handheld or hands-free cell phones. So,
but then again, we don't know if those are causal.
That's true.
Okay.
But these those things being involved, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My guess is probably there is some relationship.
And 100% of car accidents, a human and a car was involved.
Oh, come on.
I'm just saying that there's no causal of
those
things necessarily.
That's true.
But we can talk
about this two ways, right?
Yeah.
There's the scientific way where you say, it is not scientifically proven that water is required for human life, right? Okay, well, yeah, but there is
a massive amount
of evidence. I mean, so about things and the way we talk about things colloquially is different, although it is important not to confuse correlation and causation. The only thing I'm saying is these numbers are going up, and I just wanted to say, don't talk on the phone while you drive. There's been a massive amount of scientific evidence to show that when you're talking on a phone and you're holding it, or if you're talking on a phone and you have a hands-free device, you're still pretty much just as distracted. It's not about holding the phone. It's about the attention being away from what you're doing.
Yeah.
What you're doing is a life or death situation.
Driving.
So.
I think when cell phones ring in cars that are moving, mm-hmm. the cell phone ringtone should be, answering this phone is probably hazardous to your health. Right? So understand every time that you're going to interact with it, you're choosing to be more dangerous.
Yeah.
Right?
And as conservative as I feel on this topic, I still get tempted all the time to talk on the phone because, you know, you're sitting for a while. You can't really do all that much.
I have found my technique is to pull over.
Yeah.
I just pull over a lot now.
Yeah.
And the big X factor is, just that you only have a second to make that break happen. You know,
that's
if
right.
something happens
yeah.
in front of you,
yeah.
you're not going to have time. And if your attention is distracted, you're not going to have that extra second that could save people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I do, even when I'm like late for work or whatever, I'm, like rushing to take kids to school or whatever. If I'm going to listen to music in the car, before I move the car, I turn the music on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then, all I'll have to do to disengage with it is turn the volume down. Right. And at least that's the minimum necessary. I don't have to find my phone and click on a screen or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And if
yeah.
I do want to do any of those things, like a call comes in, and I think, oh, that's a ringtone that's important, whatever. I pull over when I can and then call them back. Because you know what? You can call people back. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And we survived this long, without, before texts and before cell phones, you're going to be fine.
Yeah. and one other sad statistic is that motor vehicle crashes are still the number one cause of death for teens. So if you're a parent and you're raising a kid, try and build that into them. Don't talk on the phone when you're driving. Be a good example for them too.
And something good with that is there are apps that you can install that will detect when you're in a moving vehicle
mm-hmm.
and can take actions like turning off the ringer so that you're not tempted to grab the phone out of reflex. I would suggest installing that.
Yeah. I should do that too. The temptation is really the thing that gets you.
Exactly.
So a quick story. I just want to mention that we've moved more in artificial life.
Mm-hmm.
Another milestone's made. We've been talking about some pretty big movements in this space in the last few years have been that we've been able to synthesize the genome of a relatively small virus that was hepatitis C. We got a complete synthesization, which means we can build that virus like from machine, which is amazing. We've also been able to do the first synthetic cell. Now, what that was actually taking the inside of one cell, of one organism, and putting it in a different cell. And basically, that's a synthetic sense in that the shell itself is not part of the original organism.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent is a fully synthetic chromosome. This is of a yeast cell. We were able to create this chromosome and insert it into a cell, and that cell was viable. Yeast repopulated, and new genomes were added to the organism to do things like a self-destruct, which is really important when you're genetically altering life at this speed.
That's wacky.
So we're moving forward to complete artificial cells, which is kind of neat.
You know what's amazing? So much of what we do is just trying to manipulate matter.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Like all the stuff you were just talking about. We're just trying to manipulate matter in the way that we want, and there are all these crazy hoops and that we have to jump through to make it happen.
That's we didn't talk about flying things this time. Does anyone have a flying story, something that flies?
Me.
Okay.
Oh, ooh, go.
Before April 4th, check out the link that I'm going to put up on geekspeak.org for naming the new Goodyear blimp. They have a new blimp out. It's actually not a blimp. It's a semi-rigid airship.
I'm not going to hear that a lot.
Cause it's hard
that
to
won't
say.
Be in the headline.
Yeah, it's not great advertising.
So time to name the Goodyear semi-rigid airship.
Exactly.
Is that a dirigible? What's the? Do you know the difference between all those terms?
A blimp and an airship?
They said that this is not considered a dirigible.
Okay.
I think
dirigibles are blown up. And this thing, if it was deflated.
Oh, I was thinking about, oh, no.
No, they're balloon-type vehicles. Yeah. This airship, actually, its walls are, like, it maybe would collapse a bit, but it's not like it's a balloon.
It has, like, a skeleton with a polyester covering on it.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah. And so they've got a new one, and they want naming. And so there's a contest to do naming of that, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Quick Google update, Ben.
Google Now is now coming to Chrome. That's the technology that says, hey, you were going to work and there's a traffic accident, so take this freeway instead. That kind of stuff.
And coming to Google Chrome.
Yep, yep. Up until now, it's just been on mobile.
Lindsay, 3D printing or medical news?
How about both?
Ooh, cool.
A woman got a 3D printed skull put in a 24-hour surgery.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
It saved her life. Basically, there's a company called Anatomics that 3D prints medical devices.
Yeah.
And they used to have to make this stuff by hand with clay, and it was never a precise fit and very difficult to deal with. She's, after three months, she's back to work, and she's fine.
She has a new skull.
Yes. Usually it's just parts, but they almost did the entire, like, top part of the skull out of this plastic, 3D printed, and it fitted perfectly and resolved all of her
symptoms. My dentist does that with fillings, right?
Yeah. He
scans my tooth and then carves it down, scans it, and then prints a 3D thing.
Yeah.
But, well, actually cuts it, detractive. But that's amazing. I mean, selling jawbones, but I can't imagine a skull surgery. I mean, is that, it's amazing.
Yeah. 3D technology printing, we didn't know how far it was cool. Gonna go.
That's a lot more impressive than my 3D printing story, which is a 3D printed tape measure.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. They're trying to make all the tools in a toolbox out of 3D
printing. Oh, that's cool. Okay, I can see that.
Skulls are still cooler, though.
Absolutely. Right. Hey, this is Geek Speak on 88.9 KOSP, KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Ben Jaffe. This has been another episode, actually, for March 29th, 2014. Hey, Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3, which means you can do anything you want with our content. All you have to do is tell them the Geek sent you.